Welcome to the new and improved Configure It Done podcast. The Configure It Done podcast is now a place where we interview senior thought leaders in the SAP space across Australia and New Zealand, and the aim is to tap into their knowledge so we can pass on their insights to the listening SAP community. Configure It Done podcast. We've got a fantastic guest, Matthew Norser.
Yeah, how are you going?
I'm good. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. The reason why you're here is we interviewed John Golphin a couple of years ago.
I listened to that one.
He said that we need to interview yourself. But how do you know John, first of all?
We worked at Arthur Andersen together, now Accenture, in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. I joined in 87, he joined in 88. We worked together. Then in about 1994, we started EBT Consulting together, mm-hmm. which was sort of just contracting ourselves out to projects. But I was deeply involved with John Golphin. He's a great character, mm-hmm. Enormous intellect, and a consummate professional. I'll probably put all of those together in a single person.
Yeah,
he likes to sing as well.
Yeah, he's definitely
can't
a character.
Stop him.
But yeah, we definitely we learned a lot from John on the podcast about his approach and how he's into the detail. But he said we should be getting yourself on the podcast because I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you used to be a consultant and you've shifted into more of a sales-based role. But yeah, tell me a bit about your background.
There was definitely overlap. But yeah, the first 15 years of my career, I was a consultant, big ICT projects. Arthur Andersen became Andersen Consulting. Then we did EBT, mainly worked with PwC during that period. Mm. But then after about 15 years, I figured that consulting was too hard, project deadlines and all that sort of stuff. There was no relief. You'd roll off one project out of the frying pan into the furnace.
Yeah.
So I think it was my brother who was in sales for Fujitsu at the time. And I thought, I want a bit of that lifestyle, but also intensity and also reward. So I backed myself into a sales role and got poached into SAP. And I've been there ever since.
And how long's that been now?
Oh, I'm in my 20s. Almost coming up to 22 years, mm-hmm. always in sales at SAP.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Yeah. So I know we met up for a coffee before in North Sydney, and I'm really excited to tap into your approach with sales and your philosophy I suppose the longevity as well and what you've picked up on those years. But let's start at that philosophy point. I know you've got a very specific philosophy and approach to sales, but could you define that for us, Matt?
Well, one thing I'd say is that I think sales is an underrated profession, and it's also a really difficult profession, and one that I think there's not that many people that are genuinely good at it. Mm-hmm. I suppose part of my philosophy is that, the buying decision's with the buyer, not with the seller. So there's maybe somewhere to start. Mm. This idea that you can convince somebody to do something irrational, well, maybe you can convince them, but that's not my philosophy in sales, is you convince them to do something really rational. It's easy working for SAP because obviously they've got a brand and lots of products and lots of things to sell. So maybe I've been spoiled by, a big brand. But typically, people buy things when they're good and ready. I used to always bring it back to myself, like, what would I do in this situation if I was being sold to in this manner? And if my answer was I'd tell them to go away, then I would do it a different way. So I always tried to put be in the seat of the receiver of proposals, narratives, stories, whatever it is that you're telling them. And yeah, so put yourself in the customer's shoes. What are they thinking? What's motivating them? What's going on there? And and tailor your approach to that, not according to what you're trying to sell or what you're trying to do. Do the right things and the right result generally happens. Mm-hmm. Not always, but often. Not rushing sales, this idea that you've got to sort of be agitating and pushing. I'm not sure that works either.
Mm-hmm.
I've told you before, everything deserves a sleep. Rushing, you know, artifacts out to the customer, I don't think that works either. I think you're better off thinking about things and testing and improving and consulting with people that you respect, getting input, thinking again about it, you know. I often used to laugh how, you know, I'd arrive in the office with other salespeople who'd just come from a customer and they're firing away their response email, you know, five actions, this and that. And I would write an email and then just sit on it, wake up the next morning and it'd be like, you know, oh, great conversation. There was one thing that really I thought maybe we could follow up. And, it, you know, I would just take my time and other people would just be on cadence and got to make action happen. And I never saw that working. I mm-hmm. always saw the slow, deliberate response. I mean, you got to understand time frames and, you know, the mechanics of things. But, yeah, just being well considered, I think, is a really strong sales philosophy.
It's a really interesting point, and it's very similar to the recruitment industry as well. And when you've got KPIs and sales targets and deadlines to meet, and you know, then you couple the you know people with it, like that want and need to do well, and you know, it's very very hard to implement that and really kind of just settle and like I love that catchphrase you use, like everything deserves a sleep. How did you develop that catchphrase, and I guess what's your message to those eager people that want to get a deal, you know, done and over the line? And even because in some instances it is the best thing for the customer, but you're right, it sometimes it just needs to, you know, that slow, steady, considered approach. But what how did that come about, and what's your message to?
Well, I started off selling to government at SAP, and you know, government work at a different cadence. You know, you've got to be sort of looking down the line and reading the sort of political budget cycles, you know, themes that are going on, premier's priorities, wherever it might be. So that sort of settled me down from a, you know, sort of instant reaction type sort of mode. How did I get to that sort of belief system almost? I'm not really quite sure. I think it was probably the fact that I was selling to government in the first instance, and the cadence of that made me really sort of deeply consider, well, what's actually going to cause them to buy something? And, you know, the need to create a body of evidence that they could then rely on in through their processes, that was huge, and that always took time. It wasn't like you'd fire off a product brochure and you were sort of done and ready to sign a transaction of some sort. That just would never happen. I think I was, or maybe consulting helped, I was always a good listener, so I wouldn't sort of really make a move on something until I felt I understood what the right move was. And I would often, I had good managers too. That was a, you know, sales managers that are just in your face trying to get you to do unnatural things was never where I wanted to be. But a sales manager that would ask questions and sort of ask you the same question maybe day after day to see how you were varying your response, and then they would come up with some sort of pearl of wisdom that would help, you know, unfold a customer circumstance. But listening and deeply considering, maybe you call it quality time. I don't know. It's a difficult question to answer. Just really deeply considering what you're doing, I think makes a huge difference. And testing that with people that are, you know, high quality people that aren't trying to tell you what to do, but are trying to actually coach you into doing, which is something I've done. I've done a fair bit of sales coaching, and I think I was well coached by my first manager at SAP, who probably I've modelled my style on a little bit. So that's interesting. So I don't know. That's a long-winded answer to your question.
Sure. So when I interview like recruiters, I value salespeople and recruiters that value the relationship over the deal. And I'll give you an example. I think one of the best approaches is Apple.
Yeah.
And when you go into their store and say, you want to buy a phone or you want to buy anything, an iPad or a phone, and the seller, they slow you down and they say, look, what do you need it for?
Yeah.
And they will only sell you what you need and they won't go over the top.
Yeah.
And I think that's a company that's valuing a relationship over selling as much as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
Matt, you're very considered and you've got that ability to slow down. But how has your approach changed over time from Matt 20 years ago to Matt now?
Well, I'm much better considered now. So you put the pieces together a lot faster. And that Apple thing is sort of true, because SAP is similar. When you've got a lot of products to sell,
yeah,
you actually have to do genuine discovery on what it is that they want to buy, mm-hmm. and what's motivating that. But I think at first I had some bad meetings with customers where, one famous one where the CIO in an insurance company, I turned up, I've got to get a meeting with the CIO. And then I turned up to the meeting and I realised I've got nothing. I've got nothing to tell him. I was completely unprepared. So, preparation is probably something that has changed a lot over time,
mm-hmm.
Researching people, organisations, in the government sphere, there's a massive amount of information, budget papers and, reports, white papers, whatever else that might be going around. They do annual reports, surprisingly, as well, that, articulate their business really well.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe research and preparedness is something that I've changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The teams that I run, I really sort of encourage them to be very well prepared, prepared at what questions they might want to ask, what they don't know, handling objections, et cetera. So, yeah, just really think things through and be prepared for meetings, because I think I really did not do that enough in the early days and mm-hmm. came out of meetings thinking I must have looked like an idiot in that meeting. I had nothing for them and I had no questions and no, it was just like a meet and greet.
Mm-hmm.
And, most people don't want that.
Sure, sure. So you mentioned like preparation is key. And obviously I've noticed you've coached a lot of people in your time as well. And when you're coaching, I always find analogies and catchphrases really important to get a message across. Have you got any like go-to catchphrases that really double down on your philosophy?
There's some of the chestnuts, like, two ears, one mouth. Uh-huh. That's definitely everything deserves a sleep, mm-hmm.
Love that one.
The power of the artifact is one of my sayings, that if you don't represent your thinking, your proposition, your plans in a document, then where's the evidence of any work done, in a sense? So injecting a really well-articulated document into a customer, that has a lot of power, especially if it challenges them or it's, in the government space. If you put something into a customer that says, we think what you're doing is the wrong approach, how about this idea? They're almost obliged to think about it because... Mm. It's on record then that you've recommended an approach. The power of the artifact's a big one. That's a really deep-seated truth, in my view, that's hard to sort of speak about easily. But it's really putting your thought into something that is then a historical representation to a customer of something. It doesn't have to be a proposal. It might be a point of view or a technical paper or something. But
and typically, what part of the, I call it a sales process, would you have that?
All parts.
Okay.
I've seen, where we've injected a thought document into a project that's post-sale that's actually going wrong, and we're sort of like, hey, this is our brand, this is our product. we actually think you should do X, Y, and Z. And they've had some powerful effects, because if you're the vendor and they're sort of disregarding the vendor and doing something a certain way and then it all falls apart, you know, that's on their head, not on ours. So,
sure.
You know, you need to, but I'd say at all parts of the sales cycle, I think proposals are probably really important, because if you misrepresent truth or misrepresent something, that can be catastrophic as well, both commercially but also reputationally, et cetera. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of representing numbers really accurately and really digestibly, if that's such a word. The amount of times I look at proposals that people do and it's like, I don't understand what that's saying at all. What about this? What about that? You know, it's what are you trying to say? Where do you want them to focus? You know, what's the true narrative of what you're saying, and is it consistent? But, yeah, in the sales cycle, I think there is activity right across there that needs output. Whether even plans, so you start something, you've got to articulate a plan. So I'm a believer in account planning or territory planning, and not just a token gesture and not focused on numbers and transactions, but focused on who is this customer, what do they think, what are they doing, what's their business, what motivates them, you know, what gets them up in the morning, maybe what causes them to not sleep at night as well. Deep understanding of your customer is probably another catchphrase. Yeah, I'm not sure how you get it right unless you understand your customer.
Sure.
And this is when I say sales is a difficult profession and few do it well. You know, I don't think people do any of those things that well, really. Even myself, over my time, it's...
I'm pretty sure sales is the number one in-demand skill set worldwide.
Yeah. Well, I would say... I mean, it's interesting, even just from a recruiting point of view. You know, you see these resumes where there's like 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, and you suspect they've padded it out. It's really 15 months, 12 months, you know, whatever. And so there's a lot of, and I wouldn't big note myself, but there's a lot of, let's say, pretenders amongst that, whereas a good salesperson is unmistakable. You know, like, and I know quite a few of them that have come through SAP, certainly. But it's in demand, I think, because, you know, it's a rare thing to have a truly exceptional salesperson.
Yeah. Well, it's got such a low barrier of entry.
Yeah, that's right. What skills do you demand that's demonstrable? University degree? Well, is that really going to... Maybe it speaks to their intelligence. Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, where do you find good salespeople as well, and what are you looking for is another difficult thing. You know, it's somebody selling in an app store for Apple. Would they be suited in enterprise, selling to top end of town banks, governments, and, you know, major retailers, et cetera?
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Well, so many times, and I've been guilty of this as well, when you hire people based on their experience or what they've done, and you do get it wrong, because it's such a subjective thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, well, try hire a salesperson that has on their CV that missed my target 5 years in a row.
Yeah.
So I think often, you know, the truth is stretched a lot with salespeople, and I think that's true of their CVs as well.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to time or deals done or performance. I like a salesperson that explains to me a really bad sales year and what happened, you know, and okay, I can... Well, there's an interesting point. I always say that my best sales year was 2007, and I did 8% of my number.
Yeah.
But I did everything right that year, and we built an enormous sort of pipeline of activity for following years. So sometimes, you know, talent and success needs a deeper look as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And sometimes I think there's a message in that, not only for salespeople that are interviewing for a role, but also consultants and managers. And I think mistakes are your biggest asset. And when typically when we go for an interview, we speak about our successes.
Yeah.
And I think if we can have like breed a culture where we're getting vulnerable and talking about our mistakes, and because sometimes that, you know, that's, you use the analogy of that salesperson missing 5 years in a row.
Yeah.
If they've actually missed 5 years in a row and they're still there and wanting to do it, you know, and you can nurture something.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're actually the best people.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of luck in sales as well that people don't, you know, speak about a lot. You know, you get a good territory, you get a bad territory, you get a good manager, you get a bad manager, you get, you know, it can be very varied. You hit a customer or a territory right in a buying cycle, you know, you can do brilliantly but be very average. So you've got to look a little bit beyond luck as well.
Mm-hmm.
Be a bit nervous if I hired somebody who had missed 5 years in
a row. Yeah. I mean, that's an extreme analogy. Yeah.
I also believe that salespeople need to bring a core skill into what they're doing. I was fortunate I did 15 years of consulting, and most of that was SAP projects, probably a good 12 of the 15 years.
Yeah.
So I brought a deep skill of project world, trying to get value out of enterprise software, right? But if you're working with retailers and you have a supply chain background or a, you know, customer-centric, if you bring a core skill into it, I think that's a lot better. I'm not sure I believe in the professional salesperson who've done nothing but sales.
Well, this is a really interesting question. And I mean, how much have you lent on that previous experience as a consultant? And I'll add another question to that. Do you think someone without a core skill can be successful, and have you seen it before?
I have, actually. They've got to be really, I'll use the word humble, maybe.
Yep.
That they've got to rely on other people's, you know, that's another trait that I don't like in sales, but I'm the person, I'm the guy, you know. Everything pivots from me. It's like a quarterback analogy versus, you know, maybe football, which is sort of 11 equals, really.
Yep.
Maybe the goalie's the odd one out. I don't know. but yeah, so, you know, there are, to answer your question, I've relied on my early skills a lot in putting pieces together at a customer. You know, often we sell software into an environment where they've already got projects running, already got software installed. They're enhancing it or augmenting it or doing something like that. So if you don't understand that landscape and what goes on to get them there, then... But the professional salesperson that doesn't bring a core skill, if they are, you know, a real collaborative team sort of person and maybe a rallier of people, you know, with a bit of humility, because giving other people the respect and the kudos for wins and all that, then maybe that is a core skill anyway. It's sort of working with people and getting the best out of others can be a great sales skill.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there about being humble and being willing to learn. Like, yeah. I've always said, the day you think you've conquered a role is the day you should retire.
Probably right. I mean, the sort of the arrogant, brash salesperson, maybe it works in some industries. I don't know. If you're going out to a mining site and you're a big, bold, burly, you know, I don't know, alpha male, maybe that might work. You know, people once asked me, you know, what do you put down your success in sales into? And one of my answers was crooked teeth. And they were like surprised. What do you mean, crooked teeth? And it's like, well, it disarms people. You're not perfect, you know. Mm-hmm. You turn up to a government agency in a, you know, $300,000 Ferrari and a $4,000 suit and a $20,000, you'll get no respect at all. If you're a real sort of normal person that is. So, that's another long-winded answer.
Yeah, I like it. It's good.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of on the same lens, but the word sales, it has a negative feel about it. Why do you think sales has a negative lens?
I think the behaviour of salespeople historically, you know, with many exceptions, and maybe it's on average, has been appalling.
Mm.
You know, like just the way they treat customers, treat people, treat transactions, hide the truth, manipulative, you know, sneaky, you know, political, you know, whatever it might be. I think that's probably true, probably even as true as anywhere in the technology space. You know, they bring another wave, you know, AI is another wave, which people suddenly see dollars. We're going to make lots of money out of AI. We just got to figure out what the message is and where our product is, you know.
Mm.
I think the historical behaviour of salespeople deserves a bad reputation.
Mm.
So I think that's why, you know, sell and run. So it's not about the customer. It's about doing a transaction, making some money and getting the hell out of there.
Yeah.
Which sometimes that's the right model, I don't know. But, yeah, I think the reputation is, you know, what have you got? You've got used car salespeople, new car salespeople. They'd probably say real estate agents, you know, maybe religious leaders, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, some of the selling that goes on is pretty cheap and nasty and manipulative and short-term focused and not customer focused.
Yeah, I always say to the team, as soon as you use the word I,
yeah, that's right,
it's you're probably in a bad spot there.
Yeah.
It's
one phrase I promised I would never use as a manager was, I need this deal.
Yeah.
Because not about me. You
exactly.
Know?
All right, so, Matt, you said about AI earlier on, and I'm really keen to learn from yourself where you think AI is going to help, or do you think it will hinder, or do you think it will take over the industry? Because there's a lot of you out there. I personally think it does have a space, in the, especially in the sales industry as well. But yeah, I'd love to get your view on AI.
It's a big question. I mean, an IT company loves the noise that's going on, you know, whether it be Y2K or mainframes going to client server or, you know, on-premise going to cloud. AI is something new, so everybody jumps on the bandwagon, and you look at every single tech company has now got a Wall Street narrative about their move into AI. I think it's going to be really varied, and I think different industries will get disintermediated in different ways. The other thing too is AI has been around for a long time. You know, supply chain optimization is, you know, code generating optimized results or more optimal results. You think of the chess program that beat the Grandmaster World Champion, I think it was Kasparov or Karpov years ago. That was a form of AI, very narrowly focused. If you look at different industries, like the artistic industries are really being, you know, taken apart. You know, if you're a graphic designer, AI is already close to taking away jobs in that area, or certainly changing the nature of it. If you're in sales, I'm not sure it's going to be that. Or if you're a plumber, you know, AI might help you detect things, but you're still going to be a plumber, you know, in maybe 50 or 100 years still. So I think AI is going to have a real sort of scattergun effect where some applications are mind-blowingly amazing and other industries seem to just not really, it'll be economically based, you know. I think you take something like the supply chains around the world and the inefficiencies and the need for carbon net neutral and those sorts of things, I think intelligent solutions will probably help that a lot. So it's a really mixed question, but I think the industry loves it because we've got now got something to push and to sell. But I don't think anybody really knows how it's all going to unfold. The doomsday scenarios of intelligence taking over, and I mean, we're a long way from that, I suspect. But radical breakthroughs happen. You know, the invention of the silicon chip was an amazing breakthrough. Quantum computing might change the nature of speed of computing, so therefore algorithms can cover an incredible amount of time, you know, very quickly to make decisions about certain things. You know, the nature of jobs has changed heaps over history.
Yeah, yeah.
The Industrial Revolution, you know, it's like you don't have people moving stuff around by horse and cart, but you have, you know, steam engines pulling them along tracks.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major disruption to a whole body. It's like Uber versus the intelligence of Uber, let alone anything else,
yeah,
versus the intelligence of just a taxi.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference right there. It's using technology. It's blending it in with the real-time activity. Yeah, I think there's a lot of machine learning, what we used to call machine learning apps out there,
mm-hmm.
about scanning big volumes of data and trying to make some sort of sense of it. And,
yeah.
Q&A against that data. Human intelligence, the human metaphor maybe is a way of describing it. I think that's got a long way to go, but maybe it's some breakthrough algorithm that causes a learning. Somebody once said that you're born with a gigabyte of data, like in your genes and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And then the average human of average age has like, I think I heard the figure of like 10 terabytes or 100 terabytes of data. So we're a machine that starts off pretty ignorant and learns over time. If you can metaphor that into code and into AI, who knows what's possible?
Mm.
I think a lot of the controls around the world that they're thinking on, how do we control this beast, both in, you know, from an industrial relations sort of level, but also from a doomsday scenario, how do we protect ourselves?
Yeah,
I think that's all worth it. In the end, I think we've probably got a little bit more time than we think.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be this decade, but it might be in the next couple of decades. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think maybe everyone's guessing as well, because, yeah, an algorithm breakthrough, something amazing could happen, and that could change everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd love to ask you to go back 20 years.
Yeah.
Just on advice, the advice piece.
Yep.
Obviously, this has been a very kind of sales-focused podcast. So, Matt, as a young salesperson, what would you tell?
First thing I'd say is take the job with SAP. Because I did question myself deeply, you know, at the time. Probably around preparedness and thinking about what you're doing, not just sort of like strolling in and going to meet a customer, yeah, how are you going, you know, whatever. But actually, you know, who is this customer? You know, mm-hmm. research them. What have you got to say to them? Where are you trying to direct them and lead them? You know, don't think in terms of weeks and days. Think in terms of years, you know, especially if you're at the top end of town. You need to build long arcs, as they might call it in storytelling, with those customers. So
it's a bigger picture. Yeah,
yeah, think of the bigger picture and maybe that's a way of phrasing it. What arcs are you trying to create, you know? Selling to government, sometimes it's a whole government cycle,
yeah.
You know. Change of government could happen, so we've got to have something going on that takes us into the next government, you know. Considering sort of the cycles of what you're doing and, you know, I would have told myself to slow down a bit earlier,
mm-hmm.
as well as being prepared. You know, I probably would have told myself to... not that I think this is a trait that I did have, but always be respectful of all levels. You're not just trying to sell to C-levels, you know. In a government sphere, most of the work's done at the executive director level,
yep.
You know, and most of that's informed by people below them.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, the respecting of all levels of people and respecting individuals, you know, it's like a diversity and inclusion comment. It's like, it doesn't matter who you come across. If they're in your customer base, listen to them. Understand what their point of view is, build that into the context of that organisation, may or may not influence how you go about your sort of process,
mm-hmm.
or your attempts. Yeah, but respecting people is a really, you know, there used to be a little bit of laughter in the sales world where they'd come back and comment on how much of an idiot that customer was or, you know, and it's just like, well, that's your point of view for a start.
Yeah, yeah.
I never used to love that, even though we had a lot of laughs at times.
Mm.
Yeah, there's... I probably would have told myself Maybe one of my comments is that I've always considered myself 49% coin operated. You know, coin operated is like a description you give as a salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I was trying to do well and, you know, in the realm of sales, but never let that tip over into be the reason you're doing stuff.
Yeah.
The 51% would always dominate, which would be about customer focused, understanding, respecting people, all that sort of stuff.
Well, the 49's a byproduct.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, people are employed to earn a living. So, you know, there's nothing. Going back to your original comment about, you know, why sales got a bad reputation, if done right, I think it's an honourable, required profession.
Absolutely.
And maybe an underrated profession. That's.
Excellent.
Another bit of rambling for you.
That's good. That's good, Matt. Well, listen, thank you for today. We'll end on. That comment of what arcs you're trying to create, that's a brilliant analogy. I'm going to steal that, if that's okay.
Yeah, steal anything you like.
For the team. But now, thank you for coming on. That was very, very
thanks
insightful.
For having me again.
Yeah. And that's brilliant.
Good on you, Jay. That was a lot of fun. Thanks.
No worries. Thanks, Matt. Please like, share, comment, and subscribe to the Configure It Done podcast.